From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll explore news literacy, what it means, and how it can help people better understand a rapidly changing news environment. We'll hear the story of two brothers from Afghanistan, now living in Milwaukee, and how a pause on federal funding to refugees could affect people like them.
From my own experience that I have as a refugee and the first generation in the United States, it would be impossible if you don't have any support from government.
Plus, we'll explore the history of Latinos in Wisconsin and the intersection of faith and belonging.
We have moments of great community, of great collaboration between different communities, but also moments where there has been friction. And I think into the 21st century, we see that we're still working out a lot of those questions.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. It's National News Literacy Week, but what that term means can vary depending on who you're talking to. It's a term that Patrick Johnson spends a lot of time thinking about. Johnson is an assistant professor of journalism and media studies at Marquette University, who teaches students how to engage with news. He joins me now to talk about the importance of news literacy and how to help people better understand the work of journalists. Patrick, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, great to be here.
We have this term, news literacy, and I think everybody has their own idea of what that means. What do you mean when you say it?
Yeah. News literacy, much like media literacy, digital literacy, algorithmic literacy, you put the different adjective in front of literacy, we kind of seemingly are gravitating towards it left and right. But when I think of news literacy, I think of it in two ways. First and foremost, I think of it as a common definition of to think and act like a journalist. So the means of which you can access information, analyze information, think about that information. I also think of it in a much more critical way, in which it's not simply just that singular sentence to think and act like a journalist. It's also moving much deeper to change the way in which we think about what we call domains within news literacy. The first of which is context, that news literacy is not simply just reading the news. News literacy is understanding the social, historical, economic, political context of the news. So for example, as I'm sitting in this studio with you, it's not just producing a radio show. It's not you just interviewing me. It's in the confines of who is funding this radio show, the history of this radio show, down to the history of the name of the radio show. Then there's the domain of creation, which is you, Joy, you are a creator. It's understanding the role of a journalist. It's understanding the practices of journalism, how you opened the show versus how you closed the show, how you transition between me stop talking and you speaking. The third of the five is what we call content, which are those very qualitative characteristics of a story, the ways in which we understand what a story is meant to do, how it does it, and ultimately the ways in which it, maybe on a macro level, can be put together and executed. So we move from that micro, more creation-based opportunity to something much more significant and broader. The other two domains are the ones that oftentimes are overlooked in news literacy when we think about it simply from that first definition of to think and act like a journalist. The first of these final two is circulation. News gets somewhere somehow. It moves from me sitting in this studio with you to certain airwaves, to certain digital channels, and that's just one step. It then might get cut and circulated on socials, from your actual show socials to someone retweeting it to their show socials or their own personal socials. Within the confines of large organizations, it's saying, how does the Washington Post circulate? Well, they have a circulation number, but that circulation number is tied to maybe subscriptions. It's tied to understanding what a pass-off rate is. So it's much more complex. And arguably, it's more complex because it's something we don't talk a lot about. And algorithms are part of that. And so it's also integrating this almost algorithmic literacy to news literacy, where it says, someone like an Apple News, how does that information get curated? And how does that algorithmic curation get to you, Joy? And how does it look different than me, Patrick? And then finally, it's consumption, which seemingly should be part of all types of definitions of literacy. But what this also asks us to think about is those questions of bias, those questions of one's news diet, so to speak. And it's not simply just what I consume, how I consume it matters, and the ways in which what I consume changes the way in which I cognitively or socially or personally am impacted by this. So some could say it's the effect of news on you. I think it's a much deeper conversation than the word effect. It's no hypodermic needle. But what it does ask us to think about is, how does you listening right now mean I could possibly change the way you think about this term? It's those five domains. It's really where I spend a lot of my time. And I do think it's the type of news literacy we need to spend more time thinking about.
Now, when you're thinking about news literacy, a lot of this does seem to mesh with the ways in which we engage with the news here, you know, as a radio station. But a lot of the time when we use the term news literacy, it's also a kind of external conversation. So really how people, I think you called it consumption, but how people are engaging with the news. When you're thinking about news literacy, which do you put an emphasis on, or are you considering all of these things kind of at once?
I definitely consider all of them at once. And the reason I do that is I think the words news literacy, media literacy get used as a scapegoat quite a lot. I mean, you even hear it on cable news in particular, where they say, well, this country isn't news literate enough. Or they'll say, where's the media literacy? Why isn't it being taught in the schools? And it's not that it isn't. It's just that what we're doing is we're not thinking critically about all five of those domains. I mean, there's journalists that I've interviewed where oftentimes they'll say, the amount of time I have in a day is dedicated to producing my story. Well, that's that creation domain. And what ends up happening is they don't have the time to ask the question of how is this being passed off. They have an editor who then writes the SEO headline that then allows it to circulate differently, that then allows it to pass through an algorithm differently, that then allows you to view it differently. And so we have to accept that our ecosystem for information and news is far more vast than it's ever been. And what that also means is how people experience the news is going to be drastically different. And so if we want to answer the question, why aren't people more news literate? I think we as journalists need to be changing the way our models are understood so that everyday people also understand what we're doing. So when we don't necessarily tweet out something 20 seconds after it happens, just like they maybe wanted to, there's a reason. And hopefully in some way, shape, or form, it could impact news literacy and hopefully in turn impact civic engagement.
It's one of these things that I think, especially over the last couple weeks, I think has been frustrating, especially for journalists who, you know, you will try to disseminate information as quickly as possible, but there's often a lot louder voices who will disseminate their own version of the truth before you're even able to verify what the truth might be in a given situation. When we're thinking about, you know, the different ways that journalists are trying to navigate these different systems, what has that meant for engagement on the other side and the ways in which our communities are really receiving this?
Yeah, and I think that is one of the most important questions that I bet most journalists are asking. And I think it's a great question to ask because, you know, you read Pew polls and trust in the term media is at its lowest. I think we need to interrogate what that word means. I would bet you and I would say media means a whole lot more than the news we produce. But it's true that we can't keep up with the demands of immediacy that many of these consumers, these viewers, these listeners want or need sometimes. We saw this in the 80s when CNN became the 24-hour news cycle. We're no longer in the 24-hour news cycle. We're in the 24-second news cycle. And when you have, for example, so much of this information going out through social media channels that are now relinquishing their responsibility to fact check in lieu of community standards, what that means is they're getting a bunch of perspectives, some of which are not true. And journalists are trying their damnedest to give the strongest, most fact-based answer. We can use the plane crash that just occurred. A journalist isn't going to know the answer to why the plane crashed right after the social media post came out that the plane crashed. You just aren't. And in all honesty, you shouldn't just make that assumption, because there are people's lives at stake, there are people's families at stake, there are people's careers at stake. And so when you've got folks, especially in social media, encountering things that they call biased, I call it perspective, they're possibly getting false information that by the time a journalist gets the correct information out there, there is a news bubble, echo chamber, so to speak, that pretty much says, I don't care that you said that that was the truth. The people that are in my bubble say it's not. And some call that misinformation. Some call that disinformation. I think we're in a very, to use this term not lightly, dangerous information landscape, where journalists are now chasing in a way that I don't think we ever asked or thought or were trained to chase. And it's not that we're chasing because we're trying to find the story. We're chasing to correct harm. That means that there maybe needs to be other people who are supporting journalists in a way to help make sure people understand what you are doing, and that it cannot be 10 minutes after the initial post sometimes. It's not even just teachers trying to help journalists and teach these really important civic outcomes that journalism is trying to seek and aim and do. We have to be doing adult and senior education in the same way. But this problem's not going to go away in a year. We've created a system that we're now consistently fighting, oddly, the question of what is real. I don't know with AI if it's going to get easier.
Yeah. There's that classic phrase, you know, a lie is able to circle the globe 3 times before the truth is able to put its shoes on, right? Something to that effect. I'm sure I've butchered that. But you mentioned at least one of them, these helpers that you see trying to at least help people kind of understand the kind of ethics that govern good journalistic practice, having to make sure your sources are right, verify information, these kinds of things. Who are the helpers that you see in our world that can make these just kinds of realities of what the world is like, the plane being a great example? I don't know how long it'll be before, you know, they're able to have a full investigation, a hearty investigation in which they find all of these answers for us. But it's not going to be 30 seconds. It might not be 30 days. How do we make it clear that things take time and that maybe the truth is worth pursuing and waiting for?
I think we need to recognize that there are far more people in our communities that want to work for a collective good, and that journalism does not in itself work in isolation any longer. So there's teachers, I think, are one of those really easy common answers. But then there are also community leaders. You know, it seems odd to, you know, kind of, we like to separate church and state, but there are a lot of people that are deeply attached to their spiritual centers. So how can we be possibly working with, say, places of worship and leaders within places of worship to offer, say, workshops on how to read the news, understand the news, how to navigate the difference between an AI social media post, a fact-checked social media post, and a not-so-nice social media post? We have to find ways to revitalize local news. People trust local. The answers they're giving in these surveys have nothing to do, many respects, with their local papers, their local radio station, their local TV station. This has a lot to do with cable news. It has a lot to do with nationalized ways in which news is produced. We have to recognize that each community have certain common types of leaders that can activate their community differently. So, for example, are there certain types of influencers in, say, the Black community that are heavily trusted, heavily understood, are working for the betterment of their community and their system, that can be also helping to pass on these messages, who can be helping to serve as fact checkers in some respects? You can do the same in conservative communities. You can do the same in rural communities, recognizing that those communities cannot all be treated the same way, because sometimes they seek and need and respect information in different ways. And so I think it's a much more, to use Dolly Parton, I think it's a coat of many colors. It's actually looking at what is the fabric that this nation is built on And how do the threads between it and among it, which are information, connect us and to get folks within these communities to help tighten those threads so our code of many colors can exist?
Well, Patrick, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thanks for being here.
Patrick Johnson is an assistant professor of journalism and media studies at Marquette University. He spoke with me in honor of National News Literacy Week. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 20 minutes, we'll speak with an artist about his unique medium for painting portraits of Milwaukee. But first, we'll hear from two refugees who settled in Milwaukee with the help of an organization whose federal funding is now in limbo.
All the refugees are moving to the United States. They came with nothing because they are looking for better life opportunities and to start new life. New life, it means you don't have anything. You don't know how to start. So there should be someone take your hand and at least guide you.
That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Last month, the Trump administration suspended federal funding for refugee resettlement, sending Milwaukee refugee aid organizations into limbo. Hanan Refugees Relief Group is one of the agencies that helps newly arrived refugees in Milwaukee. Refugees like brothers Khadr and Bahadur Hotek, who came to Milwaukee a few years ago after the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan. With help from Hanan, its executive director, Sheila Badwan, and others, the brothers were able to make a home here. WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez shares their story.
From 2001 till 2021, Afghan people experienced freedom, education, peace, and I can say in a very high level, although we had wars, but most likely the central cities were good and very peaceful and secure. We had a German Shepherd dog, and me and Khadr, we grew up together as play buddies, I would say, if this is the right word. We were playing together. We used to play football in the back of the house with the neighbor kids. And one time we visited our uncle's house in another province, for not a very long trip, but like 20-15 days. And after we came back, all of our friends, they changed the football game. They changed it to cricket. We didn't know how to play it. I'd say we would force them to let us play twice. In cricket, when they take you out, you're done. But since we had our dog, we could force them to let us play it twice.
We really miss those days, because life here in back home country is completely different. There is people more socialized because they play outside and all came together at the same places. Here too, but it's different because we are new here. We don't know like how things working. And our dog that Bahadur mentioned, we really missed him. And his name was Rainbow. And we was choose that name from one of the John Rainbow movies.
All right.
You grew up in Milwaukee.
I grew up in Milwaukee, yeah.
It seems it's like the same comparable example if you live right now in Milwaukee and have to go to Kabul.
Yeah, it would be, I don't think I would know what to do.
You can put it that way.
Yeah, I would feel very lost. So you have these wonderful memories, and things seemed free. Of course, there were wars and there was fighting, and then things changed very quickly.
On this Monday night, fear and desperation in Afghanistan.
Panic, chaos, a staggering collapse. The Taliban have taken Afghanistan.
each province, based on their security and insecurity, kind of collapsed, and the war line was coming closer to the central, Kabul. In the meantime, things were normal in capital and president and different high-level government official were just guaranteeing everything would be fine. August 15, so this is morning around 8:30 or 9, and Nangarhar city collapsed, and we saw the pictures, Facebook post, and they're saying they got the city. So it was like we are surrounded in Kabul.
It was around 1 o'clock that the news said a president left the country. That was the worst news. And that time, I went out and see the screaming, and Saul people was in shock.
We were hiding, and we were looking for opportunity to go to the airport. The airport was surrounded by concrete walls, and there were gates secured by U.S. troops. And only those gates were your way entry to heaven from hell. Thanks God. And the last attempt, we were able to get in.
When we was able to get into the airport, I still could remember, everybody was start crying. So we was able to fly on the same day. We sit in the airplane. There was a logistic one. It was like almost 600 people in the same airplane. We was don't know where they're going to get us. When we was in the camp, we was had HP numbers, which is called like each different case. They was putting the list, and if there was your HP number, it means you can get ready for your trip, and you're going to go resettle in one of the cities. So I did check the list on the morning, and it was really surprising because I did see my HP number on it. And then the next day, February of 2022, I left camp. We went to New Jersey. There was a city called Newark. Once I moved in, I was had only $5 with me that I was took from my brother. That's how I was started with those $5. And it's really a big thing, like story of my life I can tell someone. We was walking in the street. We was see a sign. It was said, "Heroes working here." And there was no other sign to see, like, what is this place?
Yeah, we discussed, like, 3 or 4 minutes, should we ring the place or not?
I was the one that speak English, and I had no confidence on myself because, like, I was new, and I was, like, really scared. So we was discussed, like, should we go ring or maybe knock on the door to see, like, if they hire people or no? So we did knock on the door. There was a woman, she said, like, "How can I help you guys?" We just said, "We just saw the sign. Are you guys need worker?" She said, "Come upstairs." She was opened the door for us. And there was a really nice office. There was, like, the boss. We talked to him, and we told him, like, we just moved here, and we're looking for a job. He said, like, "Okay, yeah, we will give you a job." And we all was, like, so happy, and, like, we couldn't imagine at that time.
Yeah.
And he told us that you guys could start from tomorrow, $14 per hour. And the father was said, like, "No, it's 13. And we said, like, "Don't worry about the dollar." But today we know, like, a dollar, how much it's going to be a difference in our wages. So we said, like, "Don't worry about it. So it's okay."
So what was the job?
Bakery.
Yeah, I did start with packing breads. And every night we was packing, like, 2,500 breads.
Finally, we decided we want to join Raza, my oldest brother, who was in Milwaukee. And he was the primary client for Hanan Refugee Relief Group. We were 6 family members, 4 adults, 2 kids, in a 2-bedroom apartment, which is kind of very tight for a 2-bedroom apartment for 6 people. And not the very right day, but, like, we had a week until we met Sheila. And she just opened the drawer and gave us a key. It was just the front apartment to my brother's house. She said, "It's prepaid. You guys can live." It's paid for a few months' rent, security deposit, and the case manager would help you guys with the household items. was generous.
We were still starting our life because we was just here like for 6 months. So all we do have today is all because of Sheila, sister, and also Hanan Refugee Relief Group. We are really grateful for that.
We moved from New Jersey to Milwaukee. We would be like, we moved from the city to the village. I don't know if he's still on that belief or not, but I think I'm not.
Yeah, once we moved to Milwaukee and we left New York City because we was left very close to downtown, it was like American dream. Tall buildings, busy city. You got to see all those different sport cars. From my own experience that I have as refugee and the first generation in the United States, it would be impossible if you don't have any support from government. Because all the refugees are moving to United States, they came with nothing. Because they are looking for better life opportunities and to start new life. New life, it means you don't have anything, you don't know how to start. So there should be someone take your hand and at least guide you till you can afford everything by yourself. As we see most recently, some changes in the administration about all those funds in freeze, it's a negative effect on millions of individual human lives. What do you think, Bahadur, about these recent changes about funding for refugees and new arrivals?
I basically have kind of the same view. Well, I can put myself in a position, and we came in. We don't had no immediate family or relatives here. And if we don't had the agency to help us, God knows, I don't think we would have a chance talking with you right now here today.
Once I moved here in Milwaukee, I really find all these people very kind, and they was very acceptable and very welcoming. They were the one that show us how to live and how to start our life and make everything organized. But like today, I feel Milwaukee as my home. What do you think, Bahadur, about this experience?
Yeah, I think while we lived in New Jersey, we were more like a guest over there. And maybe if we stayed till right now, maybe kind of different experience right now. But at the time while we were there, basically, we didn't start our life like as we did here because we had more opportunities, more people around us. The English language that I learned is because of one of the volunteers of Hanan. We received this help and we have to repay it back one way or the other. And I think that's the kind of feeling that everybody must have. We were a time of need, and people gave us a hand.
Those were brothers Bahadur and Kader Hotek. They resettled in Milwaukee from Afghanistan in 2023 with help from Hanan Refugees Relief Group. It's one of the agencies affected by a recent suspension in federal funding for refugee resettlement. They spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. Milwaukee is known for its celebration of cultures, with its wide array of cultural festivals and the many cultural centers that call the city home. But Wisconsin's record of welcoming newcomers has been spotty, and that history hasn't always been well documented. Sergio Gonzalez is a Wisconsin native and Latino historian who was dismayed to find that much of his culture's history hadn't been researched. So he went about fixing that. His first book, Mexicans in Wisconsin, explores the history of Mexican immigrants in the state. His latest book, Strangers No Longer, explores the intersection of Latino belonging and faith in Wisconsin and how it informs our communities today.
Often when we talk about Wisconsin's Latino community, we talk about it in a couple key ways, as both a monolith and as a relatively new history, kind of from the 1990s onward. This book really dispels both of these notions. When do Latinos first start coming to Wisconsin?
Well, you know, the first recorded Latino, the one that we have historical record of, goes all the way back to the 19th century. But the large numbers of Latinos settling here really begins in the 1920s, when Mexican industrial workers were recruited to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to serve as workers in tanneries, factories, and foundries. And in many ways, they were just kind of following the footsteps of the European immigrants who had preceded them. They were coming here as cheap, controllable labor. Oftentimes, they were brought as strike breakers without their knowledge. And so they had a really tough go of it, trying to find a space to live in Wisconsin, trying to find work sites that paid them well, that treated them well. And it was not a very easy experience for them. Again, an experience that's very similar to other groups that had preceded them before.
One of the key words of this book is hospitality. And it's a word that you use in a kind of interesting way. When you say hospitality, what do you mean?
Well, you know, I think all Midwesterners have an understanding of hospitality. The way that it comes to us most is the idea of Midwestern nice. And every state has kind of its own version of it, whether it's Wisconsin nice or Minnesota nice. We like to think of ourselves as welcoming people. And I think in many ways, Wisconsinites have been welcoming to Latinos across the 20th century. But there are so many instances where Latino immigrants, migrants, and refugees have struggled to find a sense of welcome here. I like to think of welcoming as not just saying hello to somebody and bringing them into the table, but also offering them political power, social space, economic power as well. And so there's an entire field of study called hospitality studies that tries to understand the interaction between the person who is the in-group and those who kind of exist at the boundaries and kind of the conflicts, the tensions that arise when those out-group members try to become members of the in-group. And for the history of Latinos here in the state of Wisconsin, there has been a constant tension. We have moments of great community, of great collaboration between different communities, but also moments where there has been friction. And I think into the 21st century, we see that we're still working out a lot of those questions.
One of the ways that you describe this is the idea of the perpetual stranger, this idea that, well, I'll have you explain it.
Yeah. I mean, this is, for me, the framing of the book, of course, it's a question not just of Latinos arriving in Wisconsin, but how they've built community. And I look at the question of faith, specifically faith spaces and houses of worship. And within both the Old and New Testament, there is this constant evocation of the stranger and the obligation to the stranger, how Christians and Jews are supposed to welcome the person who exists at the gate. Now, the question, of course, becomes is if that person who is at the gate is consistently going to exist at the threshold of belonging, will they ever have an opportunity to actually be a full member of the community? And so I'm interested in, you know, as the book of Ephesians says, how can people become strangers no longer in a community they've called home for 100 years? And as I kind of note in the book, there's really an unresolved question here in whether or not Latinos are full members of their communities here in Wisconsin. I think many Latinos would call themselves Wisconsinites. I certainly do. I was born and raised here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But there is a constant tension of feeling, do I completely belong and do people want me to be here?
As you said, in the book, you really explore this through the church's relationship with Latino communities, going back to when Latinos originally come to Wisconsin. How did churches, parishes initially welcome these new migrants?
Yeah, I love the beginning of the story because I think it throws a lot of us for a loop. We might think of this kind of a progressive history of Latinos arriving as very difficult at the beginning, and it gets better across the 20th century. But actually, perhaps the best moments of welcome, of integration, happened in the 1920s when Latinos arrive. They find a lot of friction in their workspaces and social spaces. They settle on the city's south side. But the place where they find a home is in their churches, specifically Catholic churches. And it's white Catholics on the city's south side, specifically at Holy Trinity Church, who open the doors and welcome into the pews these Mexican Catholics who are arriving into the city. And it's that shared sense of Catholicism, right? The shared faith that exists between the two groups, even if they speak a different language, they have different cultures, they have different ways of knowing this city, that they find a sense of communion, a sense of fellowship. And so some of the most robust senses of collaboration that happen among Latino newcomers and Milwaukeeans is in developing a Mexican mission chapel on 5th and National. And that building still exists here in Milwaukee in the Walker's Point neighborhood. Eventually, that church migrates into the Holy Trinity Church. And we now recognize it, of course, as Holy Trinity Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is really the heart of Latino Catholicism here in Milwaukee.
this relationship really does change through the decades. How do we see this evolve over time when Latinos, of course, the communities that are here are also changing. We're getting new people in. But also the people who had been here initially are really have set down roots, have created communities. How does this relationship to the church change?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you mentioned at the start of our conversation the fact that Latinos are not a monolith. And this is kind of represented in the different groups that arrive in Wisconsin at different points throughout the 20th century. So Mexican immigrants arrive in the 1920s. The group that follows them are Texas Mexican Americans. So these are American citizens who were born at the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. And they come to Wisconsin to do migrant work in the 1940s through the 1970s. Their experiences are very different because they're arriving in rural Wisconsin. They're here very much temporarily from the spring through the fall. And eventually, many of them settle here in places like Milwaukee, Madison, Kenosha, Racine. They're followed by groups like Puerto Rican industrial workers who are American citizens, but they're still treated like outsiders in many ways. They arrive here in Milwaukee as industrial workers in the 1950s. And then, of course, Cuban refugees in the 1960s and the 1980s, and Central American refugees who arrive in the 1980s who are fleeing persecution but find a limited sense of political harbor here in Wisconsin. And so all of these different groups, even though they fall under the large umbrella of Latino, Hispanic, Latinx, Latine, are having different experiences with the people who arrive here and different experiences with those established Latinos who have been here perhaps for decades before.
Now, your book explores how churches not only served as a place of worship, but also often a center for political and activist organization. How did that develop?
It was, I would say, very organic, and I think it's an experience that many people have with their churches. These are not just places of worship where they can pray to their Lord, where they can practice the scriptural teaching, where they can have a sense of community with people who are like-minded in their faith. It's also a place that can serve as a social service agency, a place of education, not just parochial schools, but, you know, people learning English. And then ultimately can also be a place for political empowerment and political mobilization. So there are different moments where this happens. Of course, in the 1920s, those first Mexican migrants who arrive here, some of them are political refugees who are arriving from Mexico fleeing persecution because of their faith during a period that was known as the Cristero War in Mexico, when the Mexican state went to war with the Mexican Catholic Church. And that extends into the 1960s, migrant farm workers who turned to their churches to organize their labor unions and to boycott grapes to support migrant farm workers across the United States. And then, of course, maybe most dramatically in the 1980s with the birth of the sanctuary movement, where churches literally become places of safe harbor for political refugees fleeing persecution in El Salvador and Guatemala. And Milwaukee serves as a central hub for the sanctuary movement beginning in December of 1982 and extending all the way through the 1980s. And I think today we can still see this to this day, where Latinos turn to their churches for a number of different reasons. Again, as a place of solace, a place of fellowship, a place of faith, but also as a place of political mobilization.
Now, this is a book that was, in some ways, really born out of your desire to add to this history where there really wasn't a lot that was in a collected space. You start the book, of course, with a story about going to the library, asking for, you know, all the materials on Latino history in Milwaukee, and then finding a photo of yourself, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a stunning story. You know, you have these existential moments when you say, am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing with my life? And my first experience in the archives as a young graduate student was to literally find myself in the first document that I pulled out of a box. It was, obviously hair-raising, and it kind of really shook me. But then I put my historian's hat on, and I got to thinking about a few different things. One, the fact that there was such a limited number of archives that have been preserved about my community. And I got to thinking, what does it mean that our historical societies, our libraries, our historians have done such a pitiful job of commemorating a history that I believe is central not just to our past as a state, but is fundamental to understanding where we're going as a state moving forward. And then I got to thinking, of course, what does it mean when I pull this first image out of the box? It was a picture of me and my parents and my family walking out of a church. And that really oriented my understanding of what it means to create community, right? Looking at these different institutions that can exist in many different varieties, not just as places of worship, but of social services and of political mobilization. I'm really fortunate today that I'm not doing this work by myself. There's a growing network of Latino historians across Wisconsin, across the Midwest, who are trying to put our region on the map, right? To say that, of course, we have to focus on the Southwest, in New York City, and Miami, where there are these large Latino populations. But the fastest growing Latino populations are in the U.S. South and the U.S. Midwest. And here in Wisconsin, of course, we can look at any number of urban areas or rural areas and know that absent Latino growth and absent Latino populations, we would see net demographic decline. And so we are literally the future of the state in so many different ways. It's imperative for us to look to the past, to rectify these archival accidents, archival problems, archival lackings, and fill them in with the histories of this community.
Well, I'm sure many people are very excited to read the book. I very much enjoyed it. Sergio, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Joy. I appreciate it.
Sergio Gonzalez is an assistant professor of history at Marquette University and the author of Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin. We spoke last year. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll hear from a Milwaukee artist who uses an unusual canvas, Altoid tints. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Atomic Records, Klingers East, and the Milwaukee County Stadium. Wisconsin artist Nate Rose recently gained attention for recreating all of these local landmarks of the past as tiny paintings inside Altoid tins. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez speaks with Rose about his latest series of paintings called Milwaukee Memories and learns what inspires him.
You've recently gained popularity for your tiny paintings that you've created inside Altoid containers. What inspired you to start this series of paintings?
Well, I can't take credit for coming up with this idea. I think I saw it on Instagram or something a while back. But I just had an Altoid container laying around, and at that point I had been oil painting for about a year. So I decided to just try it out and put some paint in the bottom of the tin, use that as the palette. And at that time, I lived on the east side of Milwaukee, and so I just walked down to the art museum, sat on the grass, made a little painting of it, and that's kind of how I started the tiny Altoid painting. So it's only been about a year and a half that I've been doing these. And so the lid of the Altoid tin has a little 2x2 canvas on it, and then in the bottom part of the tin, there's little dabs of oil paint, the various colors that I use, and then kind of in the middle of the bottom part of the tin is where I mix them. The little painting itself will probably be dry in about a week, but these little dabs of oil paint could be wet underneath for months and months.
And when did you start the series of painting Milwaukee memories or Wisconsin memories?
Like 6 weeks ago. Yeah, this is like a pretty recent thing. It was actually a shower thought, I think early October, maybe late September. I was actually thinking about what local landmark I wanted to paint next. And I was like, oh, it'd be nice if I could paint like Port Plaza Mall in Green Bay, which is no longer there, but I grew up in Green Bay. It was kind of like where we always hung out. And then I thought to myself, well, why not just paint it? And so I did a bunch of research and found photos and tried my best to remember kind of like what it looked like, what the vibe was. And then I just painted it, took a picture of what's there now, which is really boring.
And you mentioned Port Plaza Mall, but for listeners who aren't familiar with your work, tell me about some of the places you have painted.
Well, here in Milwaukee, I painted Atomic Records, which was on Locust. Closed around 2009, I believe. I painted Klingers East, which closed a few years ago, also on Locust, but in River West. I painted Fuel Cafe, which was on Center Street in River West, and Milwaukee County Stadium. So those are the Milwaukee landmarks that I've painted so far.
And tell me a little bit about the memories that you associate with those places.
I have a lot of memories with all these places. So far, all of the memory paintings that I've done are places that I have personal connection to. So Atomic Records, I used to live above it on the Oakland side. Me and my buddy were DJs at the time. This was 2008 to 2009, so we had like four turntables set up in the living room. We'd go down to Atomic and buy records all the time, and then we actually lived there when it closed. So when I started this series and I thought about what to do in Milwaukee, Atomic was like the first thing that came to mind. And then Klingers East is just like very cozy kind of Wisconsin tavern. I have many fond memories of watching Packers games there and, you know, just eating burgers and cheese curds and all that. And then County Stadium, I just went there all the time as a kid with my dad. We'd go to Brewers games all the time. And then Fuel Cafe, I didn't go there a ton when I lived here in 2008, 2009-ish. But I would definitely go there sometimes and just, like, sketch and hang out.
Can you walk me through the process you go through to create a tiny painting? From even the beginning step of how you decide what you're going to paint.
So first off, I look for things that are either visually interesting, like the Milwaukee Art Museum, or that have a personal connection to me, or that are just sort of weird roadside attraction-y, strange things, or that have like a big nostalgia factor. I made a tiny painting of the world's largest potato masher. In September, I went down to Iowa, made a tiny painting of the world's largest strawberry. I live right down the road from the world's largest hex nut. So yeah, always looking for these like weird, kind of kitschy roadside attraction type things. The second thing then is doing a lot of planning, actually. Sometimes I'll just go out into nature or wherever with my paints and like a blank canvas and just do something on the spot. More often than not, though, like I'll visit the place once, take a bunch of reference photos, kind of note the weather, note like where the sun is, note like if it can be a windy day or if I need it to be still. Is there going to be water? Do I need like the reflection of something? There's a lot of planning and thought that goes into that. And then once I'm ready to go, like, and I have a plan in mind, then I'll get my paint all together and everything and then, like, head out and then go make it. Some of these, though, I've done, like, at home. Obviously, I can't go and, like, see Atomic Records or County Stadium. So those I do at home after doing, like, a bunch of research. And so for the ones that no longer exist, like, I'll try my best to find stuff online, photos to reference and things like that. Hopefully there was something, like, in an old newspaper. But also if it's something that's been around since 2007, I'll use the Google Maps Street View. So all of these things. And then basically when I'm ready to go, it's for these tiny paintings, it's just putting the oil paint in the bottom of the tin. And that's basically my palette. And I have a bunch of tiny brushes and then I go for it.
How long does each painting take you?
The tiny paintings, probably like 2 hours for a really intricate one. Like the Atomic Records one has a lot of detail, you know, a lot of lettering and things like that. Same with the Fuel Cafe one, Klinger's one. Actually, all the Milwaukee ones took about 2 hours now that I think about it.
And what would you say your favorite part of the process is when you're painting?
Well, I just like that you can do whatever you want. Like, it's pretty nice. Like, you can always change anything. The Fuel Cafe painting, I put a squirrel smoking a cigarette in there because I can. Things like that, you know, just paint a little happy cloud in there like Bob Ross, doesn't matter. So I like the control, like when you paint, because you can just do anything. A lot of the cityscapes and things that I do, like I just leave out like the light poles, telephone poles, and like the wires and stuff like that, because I'm just trying to make a beautiful painting. So I think I just like that about painting, is that you have creative license to just change whatever you want.
I love that. And you also do big paintings, including abstract paintings. What inspires your abstract art?
When I'm trying to paint representationally, it's a lot of effort, takes a lot of work to do that. So after I've done that for a while, for a couple of months, I feel kind of burnt out. And sometimes I just want to like go be free. And so then I just sort of get into like a phase of abstract paintings. And for that, I usually use acrylic because it dries a lot faster and you can add a bunch of stuff to it to make it thicker, more textured, things like that. So I don't know. I feel like it's almost kind of like a release after doing these very planned out, painstakingly detailed, representational type paintings.
So what's different about painting abstractly versus painting landscapes?
Well, the obvious difference is that painting landscapes is painting something representational, painting something that's there and easily recognizable, or abstract is, you know, it's just that, it's abstract. But I still feel like there's still some kind of a connection. Like a lot of the colors that I use for my abstract paintings are actually inspired by the National Park Service posters of the early 20th century. So something about the colors that they used spoke to me. So a lot of the abstract paintings I do still use that sort of theme. So I guess they're still kind of tied into nature a little bit. Also, a lot of my abstract paintings have kind of like a radial theme. So I feel like in one way or another, I know this is an abstract answer to a question about abstract paintings, but in one way or another, like I feel like there's still some sort of natural sort of feel to them.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that answer. Before we wrap up, I do want to ask you, what do you hope people come away with after seeing your artwork, tiny and normal-sized paintings?
Well, I just hope that they have fond memories of some of these places like I do, and it just sort of hits them in the nostalgic feels a little bit. And also just you know, stop and appreciate what's there, because in my research for all these paintings, like, I found that it is very hard to find these photos of these places that are no longer there. So I don't know. I would say take a lot of pictures with your phone, because if a place goes out of business or is no longer there for whatever reason, like, it's nice to be able to look back and see them.
Absolutely. Well, Nate, thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing your artwork with me.
Thanks for having me.
Nate Rose is a Wisconsin artist who recently gained popularity for his series of tiny paintings inside Altoid tins. He spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez last year. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. There are still a few months of winter to go. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll help you prepare for cold weather emergencies, how to take care of your pets when the temperatures drop, and how you can keep yourself safe if you work outside in the cold. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.